ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello, Brooke Neindorf with you. Welcome to The Country Hour on this Tuesday afternoon. Coming up, graziers in Queensland are assessing stock losses as floodwaters continue to recede.
The sun is out, so the ground is drying out a bit, which is just letting cattle get up on top of the ground and travel a bit. We're still getting losses from pneumonia. We lost quite a lot of cattle to pneumonia, and that's ongoing, but it's starting to slow down a little bit, but certainly cattle are still very knocked around.
We'll have more on that very shortly. We'll also head back to Victoria to check in there as well as fires and recovery begins to happen in that state as well. But first today, last week we heard about a major freight line that was impacted by a derailment north of Port Pirie. Crews worked through scorching weather to get it fixed, and as of yesterday, the east-west rail corridor became operational once again. SA Freight Council CEO Jonathan Wilson says it could have been a lot worse had it happened before the Christmas trade period.
It's obviously something that you're really pleased that it was addressed so quickly. We'd prefer not to have the problems, but the fact that it was addressed within a few days really, and the time of year helped minimise the impact on the industry.
Do you know if this had a big effect on freight in terms of delays?
It probably didn't have as much of effect as it would at a different time of the year, happening just after Christmas or just in the new year, probably a little bit lower volumes as people are still on holidays. So it probably wasn't as bad as it could have been had it been later on in the year, and the backlog will get cleared up really quickly.
Did you expect it to be up and running again this soon, given the scorching conditions last week?
It's certainly very challenging conditions, you know, and obviously the safety of the workers in remediating the issue would be really, really important. It didn't surprise me, given that we've seen how efficient ARTC have been in the past, whenever there have been other incidents over the past 3 or 4 years. So we know that they get onto it very quickly. So,
and just to reiterate, you know, how important is this freight line, not just to SA, but the whole country, and what kind of freight moves through there?
Look, they're certainly very important. Our freight networks are incredibly important to all of us, to our whole lifestyle. And this east-west connection is actually not just east-west, it was actually north-south as well. This is every box travelling between Perth and Sydney, and Perth and Melbourne, between Adelaide and Darwin, Adelaide and Perth, was affected by it. The ability to move product between our major cities is really important for our lifestyle. And our freight networks are really important to us, whether we know it or not. Really, our freight networks across all of our modes is what connects our products to market. It connects us to what we want to buy. It connects us to our food. It connects us to all of our essentials, as well as getting our, you know, your Eyre Peninsula, getting you know, grains to their key markets. So we do have some really important connections, not just with this particular type of rail, but with all of our multimodal freight network.
And look, last week you mentioned the heat may have been a factor with the derailment. Obviously, this is still something that's under investigation, but do you think extreme heat is something that needs to be considered more in the future when it comes to moving freight?
We have significant climatic constraints in Australia that are really important for us to manage as best we can. But our freight networks are long and thin and are prone to disruption. And that's why we do see investment from groups like ARTC into our rail network. You know, between them and the federal government, they're putting $1 billion into our national freight network to increase the robustness of it. But we do need to see how we can address that, not just from rail, but also from road, from our air connections, from our sea connections, to make sure that we are dealing with the climatic conditions that we do get.
SA Freight Council CEO Jonathan Wilson speaking with Duncan Bailey. And in a statement, the Australian Rail Track Corporation says the cause of the derailment is under investigation and the corporation will continue to work closely with the train operator and the Office of the National Rail Safety Regulator. It's 10 minutes past 12.
The 2026 Australian Open. Hear it live and ad-free on ABC Sport Digital and take it with you on the ABC Listen app.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Now, floodwaters are continuing to recede about northwest Queensland, draining off into either the Gulf Country or south to Lake Eyre. As it rains on the east coast, the sun is starting to peek through in the west and graziers are getting out to check their livestock and properties. In terms of the known damage of the floods, the Queensland Department of Primary Industries has said that their current count, there's 51,000 missing or deceased livestock and 2,083 kilometres of fencing impacted and 3,614 kilometres of private roads have been impacted. Grazier at Argyle Station near Julia Creek, Patrick Hick, says he's expecting a significant number of livestock losses at his property. And he's speaking here with Abby Holter.
The sun is out, so the ground is drying out a bit, which is just letting cattle get up on top of the ground and travel a bit. We're still getting losses from pneumonia. We lost quite a lot of cattle to pneumonia, and that's ongoing, but it's starting to slow down a little bit, but certainly cattle are still very knocked around. We've been spending quite a bit of time up until yesterday just pushing cattle into their watering troughs and making sure they're getting out, getting a feed, getting a drink, which they were sort of not doing for themselves. I guess they were a bit shocked from the event, so we've been doing that, just basic animal husbandry. But it is getting a little bit better every day for us. There are plenty of people still on the river proper who are still in the thick of it, and the peak has not passed them yet, and they've got cattle standing around in deep water and trying to keep them alive. So we're past the worst of it, but there are plenty of people who are not. The flood peak is still moving downstream, and it's got a long way to go. And so while I'm saying that things are getting better for us, there are other people out there who the worst is yet to hit them.
It is early days and it's hard to predict, but what sort of percentage of cattle loss are you predicting for you guys?
Oh, look, it really is early days, Abby. Until we muster, we're almost guessing. I mean, it's significant, and I can tell from flying around that we're going to be well north of 1,000 head of branded cattle, but other than that, I can't tell you much, really.
How do you think that you and your community are feeling at the moment?
Well, there's probably two things going on there. There's the sort of the shock and grief, the distress of seeing your livestock die around you is extremely hard to go through, and that's sort of, at the moment, that's what most people are going through. They're not thinking about the financial consequences yet. It's just the distress of seeing your livestock die around you. That's the low point. The high point is the amazing job that our community has done doing what they can to save livestock, and it is so uplifting to see what people have done and the resourcefulness of people. It's quite amazing. We always knew we had a good community, but gee, it is really, the message is really rammed home to us in these sort of events.
What is some of the community support that you've seen around you?
Well, we basically had a little group of volunteers in Julie Creek, and it's not even a little group, there's quite a few people who just took it upon themselves to start organising, coordinating hay drops, helicopters, sourcing fuel. There's a lot of work goes into dropping hay to cattle. The hay's got to be sourced, it's got to be stockpiled, it's got to be unwrapped, loaded into helicopters, it's got to be unwrapped, it's got to be unhooked at the other end. Often it's got to be loaded on another truck and carted to a more central point. Fuel's got to be sourced. Drums of fuel have got to be manhandled and shifted. Pilots have got to be fed and housed. There's a lot that goes into it. And the fact that we have a group of people in Julia Creek, not only with the will to do it, but also the know-how and the organising capacity to make it happen off their own bat. So by the time we started to want to feed cattle, we had people in Julia Creek who basically already had the resources lined up, ready to go. It was just a matter of where do you want this hay to go, and it's on its way.
That must be a pretty heartwarming feeling to know that you were, you know, supported by so many people in your community.
Better than heartwarming. Yeah, uplifting. We knew we had a good community, but we know it for sure now.
And how does it feel to see the sun in the sky again and to know that the rain's slowing down and it's probably looking like that you might avoid some of this extra that's coming from the tropical low?
Oh, look, it's just relief to see the blue sky, which obviously we spend a fair bit of time looking skywards, hoping that we're going to get rain, but we all understand that there's too much, and we just, for the sake of our livestock, we just wanted it to end.
Grazier at Argyle Station near Julia Creek, Patrick Hicks speaking to Abby Holter. And you can see and read more about the Queensland floods online at abc.net.au/rural. Now, from floods to fires now, and the damage bill and livestock death toll are expected to rise significantly from those Victorian fires that we've been seeing. Rural reporter Annie Brown is at Fowles Wine in Avenel near Seymour in Victoria, where the vineyards have been completely burnt out and a large number of livestock have been affected. And she's speaking here to Michael Condon a little bit earlier today.
So today I've come out here to Fowles Winery. It's run by Matt Fowles and his family out here. They've been here for 20 years. It's in the Strathbogie Ranges, and people might be familiar with their cellar door that's just off the Hume Highway, sort of in between Melbourne and Albury-Wodonga in Avenel. But we've come up here to the vineyards, which are up in the hills, and it's been completely burnt out. As I look out over the ranges now from the winery, it's quite hard to see in the long distance just because the smoke cover is still so thick here, but you just see hectares and hectares of grapevines just completely burnt out and black. Weirdly though, like, you still get this little slither of green every now and then. It just shows just how random fire can be up here in the middle of it. It's been a pretty devastating week for the winery here and a lot of the growers in this region as well. It all really kicked off Thursday last week with this massive fire in the Longwood region where it started, and it moved across into this region. And then on Friday, some of the worst fire conditions we've ever seen in Victoria since Black Summer bushfires 5-6 years ago now, with huge winds and over 40 degree days. And that was when the fire also really ripped through a lot of the land and country out here. So today, on Tuesday, it's all about the cleanup and sort of taking stock of what's happened here. You can finally get into some of the roads. People are returning to their homes for the first time today and yesterday, and just sort of assessing what's been happening out here. At the winery here, it's not just their vines that are completely gone, which was 300 acres of vineyard. So their vintage is completely gone for this year, which was only a few months away from being harvested. But also the Fowles family here, they had about 1,400 head of sheep, and they've lost about 1,100 of them. So they've spent the last few days out euthanizing their sheep and burying them on the farm. So yeah, it's been some pretty hard days out here, Michael. I also got to go to the township of Ruffey, which is about 15, 20 minutes away from here, yesterday. And that is described as the horse capital of Victoria. Lots of thoroughbred studs out in that part of Victoria. And as you drove through into Ruffey, it is just, yeah, black trees, charcoaled, everything black as far as the eye can see. And also suffering a lot of livestock losses out there as well. Apologies for, like, the graphic sort of imagery of this, but you could see sort of burnt sheep on the side of the road, completely black and charcoaled. And as you drove in, there was just paddocks where you'd see deceased cattle, you know, lying on their backs and ballooned out as they do when they die. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so there's some pretty horrific images around here as sort of the region sort of comes to terms with just what happened here at the end of last week.
And have you spoken to some of the people about the firefighting effort and how cataclysmic the conditions were, and, you know, how they're feeling now looking into the future?
Yeah, so we've had, I think, over 100 houses lost in this region. We haven't got the official number on terms of livestock yet from Agriculture Victoria. I think they're still going through and assessing. There's been so many fires across the state of Victoria this week. I think they're just struggling to get out and collect all those numbers. I think we did hear on the Victorian Country Hour yesterday from the VFF that it's in the tens of thousands of stock losses. So yeah,
I think also, an early figure was 15,000, but it was set to rise.
Yeah, that sounds right. Now that was sort of going through looking at everything. Here in sort of the central Victoria part, one of the really amazing things to see has just been the dedication of people coming out here to help people who have been affected and burnt out by the fires. There's this huge mission to get hay into this area. Yesterday it was just, you just saw truckloads and truckloads of bales of hay coming in, and it's pretty remarkable to see. It's coming from all over the state. There's a huge coordination here with some of the local livestock agents just trying to get in, because although there's been a lot of livestock losses, there's still quite a lot that survived, and they're all sitting in burnt out paddocks at the moment. So getting that feed in has been really important, and they seem to work really well over the last few days. And yeah, from here on out, it's just about trying to figure out where to go to from here and what can be salvaged.
And I guess people may not understand the scale. We're talking about multiple fires throughout the state of Victoria and thousands of farms that have been destroyed, and, you know, fencing, livestock, all the machinery, all the houses. You know, the damage bill will be into the millions, tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars.
That's it. And I think that'll be the figures that'll come out in the coming days and weeks, just to see the extent of it all. Because, like you said, I'm here in Avonall, sort of looking at the damage of just one of the parts of the Longwood fire. There was also a huge fire up on the state border in Walwa in the Upper Murray that's still burning. It's been downgraded now to just a watch and act, which is good. But we've also had fires in Gippsland, in the Otways, in Skipton, over in the Wimmera. Like, it's just been relentless.
Natamuck.
Every part of the state. Mm. Natamuck, yeah. Mm. It's hit everyone all at once.
That was rural reporter Annie Brown talking about those Victorian fires. She was in Avonall at Fowes Wine near Seymour there in Victoria, and she was speaking with Michael Condon. Now, the Hereford cattle industry is mourning the loss of one of its own following the Longwood fire. Yesterday, Max Hobson was identified as the first victim of the Victorian bushfires. Mr. Hobson and his wife Julie operated a Hereford farm at Terrip Terrip near Euroa. Holbrook Hereford breeder Ian Locke says it's a devastating loss for the cattle industry.
I suppose I've sold some cows and bulls to Max over the years, so I've had some relationship with him and have spoken to him a number of times about those animals. Yeah, so I've certainly known Max, and it's just very disappointing to hear that he's come to grief.
I guess any time you hear of a loss, it's always felt in the community. But what about in the cattle community?
The cattle community is a very close-knit group of people, and we all face the same pressures and have the same understanding of what, you know, the devastation of what must have gone through with Max's own circumstances, but also his friends and neighbours around the same area that have all got their issues that they're obviously dealing with at the moment from the fires.
Do you know any more about Max and Julie? I know that they were very keen to keep the land sustainable and to leave it in a better position than what they found it, like all farmers want to do. Do you know anything more about them and what they hope to achieve?
They love their Herefords, and that was a shared interest with me. It's a close-knit family. There's lots of Hereford breeders that we've known each other for many years through swapping of genetics and swapping of stories around our love of the cattle.
So how do you think this loss will be felt?
I'm sure there's many friends and families more local to him and around about that will certainly feel this loss of Max, and my condolences to his family. That's very sad. A bit of a shock to hear.
Holbrook Hereford breeder Ian Locke speaking with Gay Patterson there about the loss of Max Hobson, who is a Hereford breeder near Euroa, and their thoughts are with Max Hobson's family and friends and the Hereford community. Brooke Neindorf with you today. It's 24 minutes past 12. In just a tick, we'll head to the Weather Bureau.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Let's check in with what's happening with the weather across the state. We're joined by Chris Kent at the Bureau of Meteorology. Good afternoon, Chris.
Afternoon, Brooke. How are you going?
Very well, thanks. What's been happening with the weather across the state?
Yeah, we've had pretty sunny conditions right across South Australia this morning and expected to continue into this afternoon and evening. Still, a little bit of smoke still lingering around the eastern border, sort of south of the Riverland there with Victoria for obvious reasons, but not a lot on the satellite that we can see today. We did see that extend as far west as sort of Adelaide yesterday, so still some sort of potential that there could be a little bit around there. But otherwise, yeah, pretty sunny conditions. We've got pretty warm temperatures across the state. It's currently sitting around 38 degrees in the north at Oodnadatta, through the Riverland, the Barossa, 24 degrees at Nuriupta, and down in the southeast in the low 20s. Coonawarra is at 22 degrees, so pretty sort of, I guess, average, maybe slightly below average temperatures at the moment. We're expecting those dry conditions really to hang around for really the next week. We will see a slight increase in the rainfall potential from tomorrow and Thursday as a new high pressure system starts to move into the or south of the state, which will reinforce some of that southerly across parts of the south. With that, the increase in moisture, we could see a few spots of rain around sort of KI and sort of those southern coasts, potentially getting up sort of into the Murraylands as well on Thursday. But doesn't look like we're going to see a great deal of rain, which is not unusual, I guess, for this time of year. We'll see those southerly winds probably also keep some of that smoke sort of away from those eastern districts as well. So those smoke plumes might end up shifting sort of more in to the north as opposed to the west later in the week. Once that high pressure system moves through, we'll see those winds turn around a bit more to the east later in the week and over the weekend. Still looking pretty dry across most of the state, but we will see temperatures starting to increase a little bit as we head into the later weekend. There's potentially another trough over WA, which might start moving across South Australia sort of maybe Sunday, Monday next week. With that, there's a slight chance that we could see a little bit of an increase in some of the rainfall, but at this stage still looking sort of reasonably dry, and any rainfall that comes is likely to be pretty isolated at this stage. So still looking very benign across much of the next week for SA. Fire dangers for SA are still sort of sitting in the higher category as well for most districts for the next or for the rest of the week. As those southerly winds come through, we will see temperatures decrease, but those increasing wind speeds may sort of lead to a little bit of an elevated fire danger, but we're not looking at anything getting into extreme over the coming week through parts of SA. So, the dry conditions continue, over the next 4 days, rainfall is likely to be, like I said, pretty light. Those southern coasts, we might be lucky if we pick up 2 millimetres, and sort of the windward coasts, maybe sort of southern parts of KI and sort of the southern Flurio, we could see totals there getting up to 5 millimetres. But very insignificant really at the moment in terms of rainfall, Brooke.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. We'll keep an eye on it. Chris, thanks for your time today. Have a good afternoon.
You too. Thanks.
That was Chris Kent from the Bureau of Meteorology. And let's go to the Western Inlands now. For the Upper Western, mostly sunny with a slight chance of a shower in the far east and near zero chance elsewhere. Chance of a thunderstorm in the northeast in the evening and wind southeast to southwesterly, 15 to 25 kilometres per hour, tending northwest to northeasterly in the morning, then tending southeast to southwesterly in the early afternoon. Overnight temperatures falling to 23 to 28 with daytime temperatures reaching the low 40s. And tomorrow for the Lower Western, sunny day with a chance of a thunderstorm in the far east in the late afternoon and evening. Winds southeast to southwesterly, 15 to 25 kilometres per hour. Tending southwesterly in the late afternoon, then tending southerly, 15 to 20 k's per hour in the late evening. And overnight temperatures falling to between 17 and 23. With daytime temperatures reaching around 40. Brooke Neuendorf with you for the Country Hour today. It is 12:30.
It's the pointy end of home renovations.
This is brilliant.
Transforming a fixer-upper into the home of their dreams. Share their ups and downs on new Grand Designs transformations. Stream all the episodes now on ABC iView.
This is ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Brooke Neuendorf with you for the Country Hour today. And coming up, Tunarama is back this weekend and it brings with it a special tradition.
It's really about honouring our seafood industry and our, particularly our tuna fishermen at that time, and seeing that fleet off to sea, and in particular just blessing and hoping and wishing and praying for safe return.
We'll have more on the blessing of the fleet very shortly. But before that, let's get to the newsroom for the latest. We're joined by Matt Coleman. Hi, Matt.
Hello, Brooke. In the news this afternoon, the federal government is seeking more information about the US President Donald Trump's announcement that he'll impose a 25% tariff on any country doing business with Iran. Mr. Trump says the change is effective immediately. Australia and Iran have an ongoing trade relationship, with wheat among Australia's key exports, as well as other agricultural products such as meat and fish. The director of the Adelaide Writers Week has resigned after days of furore regarding the decision to cancel a scheduled appearance by a Palestinian-Australian author. Louise Adler says the decision to cancel the appearance by Runda Abdul Fattah was made by the Adelaide Festival Board and came despite her strongest opposition. Since Abdul Fattah's appearance was cancelled, more than 180 participants have chosen to boycott Writers Week. And footballer Josh Cavallo has alleged that his departure from Adelaide United was driven by homophobia. In 2021, the defender midfielder became the first openly gay men's professional soccer player in a top-flight league. Adelaide United says it's extremely disappointed by Cavallo's claims and categorically rejects the allegations, including any suggestion that the club is homophobic. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thanks very much, Matt. That was Matt Coleman in the newsroom. And there, as he said, there more news coming up after the program today. Now, do you feel like you're seeing more vineyards for sale lately? Well, according to one real estate agent, national sales of properties with vineyards are slow, taking about 6 to 12 months to find a buyer compared to 3 to 6 months previously. With the industry battling an oversupply of grapes amid low prices and decreased drinking habits, who would buy a vineyard? Tim Olschwager from Colliers International says interest is limited.
The interest through the last of 2025 and coming into 2026 is going to be probably limited from buyers because of the demand situation and, you know, the oversupply. I think, you know, there's a bit of a nervousness about purchasing any of the assets that go to market, but I think there'll be interest more so from transitional players looking to convert some of the properties into horticultural pursuits or something outside of the wine grape industry.
That was my curiosity too, as you said, like, so, you know, if people are looking at it, you know, what sort of buyers might be looking? Are you sort of hearing or seeing more interest from overseas corporations or big players, or mum and dad's looking at expanding? Bit of a mix?
Yeah, it's a bit of a mix. I mean, it depends on the size of the property that's coming to market. I think some players will look at just attaching onto neighbouring properties. Maybe they're, you know, graziers or something next door that might see the opportunity to transition it back to, you know, traditional farming practices. There still will be strategic players looking to purchase properties that fits well within their business. But I think in general, the larger, probably the warmer climate regions that are, you know, big tracts of land that may suit a different crop will be looked at from various different players, from domestic and international, you know, depending on what sort of, you know, attributes that property has. And it really also, depending on if it's got water assets with it, which is a pretty integral part of their view going forward.
That was actually kind of what I was going to ask next, if certain vineyards or I guess indeed properties were more desirable than others. So you said if they've got water attached, that would up the interest for some buyers.
Yeah, definitely. You know, depending on how much and what sort of access they have will make it more attractive to those sort of buyers.
In terms of properties that are on the market at the moment, you know, a certain grape types or regions, or, you know, having a house on board, like certain locations, are any of those factors factoring into the interest as well, like, you know, Barossa versus Riverland?
Yeah, I think, you know, the varietal mix is certainly an aspect of it. You know, demand for the red grape variety has dropped off over the last few years, and some of the bigger bulk areas have been affected by lack of demand to fill some of the markets. So I think we'll see more activity in those warmer climate regions and the larger growing regions. So it's a bit of a two-tier market. Some of the smaller, I suppose, higher quality regions with got some really well-recognized established brands, I think they'll continue to do, you know, reasonably well. They've got good routes to market and things like that. So there's a few different attributes about each of them. But I think in general, the whole market is finding it a little bit difficult with the demand dropping off. But hopefully, you know, that can stabilize or balance out at some point.
Because I saw, yeah, on your website you talked about, yeah, that, you know, maybe demand's dropped off, but you still, yeah, had, what, 24 vineyards sold in the last 24 months, excess of 75 million across major wine regions. So, yeah, still wineries being sold.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's still a market. It just it takes a little bit longer to get these assets away at the moment with the market as it is, yeah.
How long are some of the properties staying on the market?
Generally, we'd like to think between 6 and 12 months you would, you know, reach a sale for some of the assets, which is extended more over the time. I mean, it used to be probably 3 to 6 months we'd have a transaction away, but it's certainly taking a little bit longer to transact at the moment.
How's that compared to other times that you've been in business, the sort of number of sales you're getting on vineyards?
Yeah, I think in general the perception is there's more assets on the market or coming to market. Some of the transactions we do aren't publicly listed for sale. They're off market transactions as well. So I think there would be the opportunity to purchase more assets at the moment. I don't think there's more assets being sold. You know, in a good market, they were still selling a lot of assets as well. So it's just a change in the whole perception, really. And I think we expect there'll be, for this year, there were probably more assets come to market, but at the moment it's not that much different than, you know, normal transactional numbers. But it's a different market we're selling into.
Do you think we've seen the peak of vineyard listings, or think more to come?
I think there's definitely going to be more to come, depending on how long the demand supply stays out of balance. I mean, really it needs to come back to a point where, you know, we're supplying what the market demand is. So there'll be a bit of time until that happens. And obviously, you know, if we can get some new markets come up and, you know, get some new buyers in the market for our fruit, which will help that and, you know, transition to the next stage.
How hard is it for people to get the green light to buy at the moment? You know, like, are there sort of any extra barriers? Like, I've heard some buyers maybe kind of only get loan approval if they've got capacity to pull out vines. Are you hearing anything like that?
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's difficult, I suppose, for some buyers to make some of the transactions or their purchasing an asset stack up with the industry in the current situation. So I think, it's difficult to finance these things at the moment. But, I mean, there's players in the market that don't particularly need sort of bank finance, for example. They might be overseas buyers with, you know, a good investor backing. So I think transactions will still occur, but it might take a little bit longer to get through the system.
And of overseas buyers, are any particular countries sort of showing the most interest?
I think, you know, traditionally we do see a lot of investment through the US, so that's sort of continuing on. I think, albeit, you know, the wine industry globally is going through difficult times, so whether that means that sort of those funds go into the wine industry would be yet to be seen, but I think there'll be a more demand for these assets if they're going to transition to other crops.
Tim Olschwager, National Director at Colliers International, speaking with Eliza Berlage. Now, where will the next transformational technology come from for the grains industry? The Grains Research and Development Corporation want to hear from growers to think about this and let the organisation know where their levy money should be spent. An online portal has been set up and the GRDC will run forums to look at the ideas put forward. And the initiative comes as growers and representative organisations discuss just how much of growers' levies should the GRDC receive. GRDC Chair Sharon Sturrock is speaking here with Cassie Huff.
It's interesting. In terms of yields, when we look in South Australia, yields have been quite variable depending where you are in the state. So definitely some of the low rainfall areas have once again had a pretty tough season, particularly the Northern Mallee and even the broader Mallee in South Australia extending into Western Victoria. Overall, across South Australia, though, I think most growers would be saying we continue to push the bounds of water use efficiency, and what was understood in terms of water use efficiency 20 years ago compared to what we're actually now able to grow on low growing season rainfall. When we think about other areas across Australia, Western Australia is this year having a really exceptional season, particularly for some areas where they might have had a tough season last year. And I'm thinking more around the northern grain belt of Western Australia. They have had absolutely exceptional yields. But overall, Western Australian yields are looking at, I think they're third or could even be their second highest yield on record. When we move across to southern Queensland, northern New South Wales, they also had a big harvest in terms of their winter crops. And when we go to southern New South Wales and into Victoria, those areas mostly had, even though there was some variability, mostly yields have actually been quite good, although there were some areas of southern New South Wales or into Victoria that really had tight yields as well. So it has been a bit variable across grain growing areas in Australia this year, but overall, I think most growers would be saying they've been surprised, pleasantly surprised at what has been achieved in terms of yield for the rainfall that has fallen this year.
GRDC is talking to growers about their feedback around the Your Priorities online portal, where there has been some consultation with growers. What are some of the main challenges that are coming through to you from that?
So one of the key challenges that we receive feedback from growers very regularly is around nitrogen and the nitrogen challenge. So over the past 30 years of investment in research, development and extension, we've had some really significant improvements around nitrogen use and efficiency. But nitrogen continues to be one of those challenges that growers continue to raise, and they raise it for a couple of reasons. Nitrogen is one of the biggest input costs. It costs growers anywhere between 10 and 16% of their crop revenue on fertiliser, and it's increasing over time. And when we also recognise that most of nitrogen fertiliser is imported, and costs are tied to global energy markets. So there are always challenges around both price and supply volatility. So nitrogen is definitely one of those challenges that growers continue to raise with us. There are other challenges as well that growers have raised through either directly with GRDC over time or through two forums that we've already had in talking to growers about where they'd like GRDC to be investing in terms of blue sky research. So thinking about new science and transformational science that will answer some of these really entrenched challenges. Some of the other challenges include things like the water productivity challenge, seasonal variability, fossil fuels and where we're heading there, and how do we use data to better make decisions. So they are just a few of the challenges. All up, we have 10 challenges. They are identified through our Your Say portal on the GRDC website. And we would really value grower input into what their priorities, individual priorities are, so that we can be investing in those areas that are going to make a real difference on farm. So we'd encourage growers over the next couple of months to really have a look at the portal and have a say and provide feedback on those challenges that have been put up there. We really want to hear from growers. We're also going to be running a series of forums alongside our GRDC update, which will be held in Perth, Adelaide, Wagga Wagga, Gundawindi and Bendigo. So we really want to hear either from growers, advisors, researchers, and others either through the portal or come along to the forum associated with those updates. We really want to hear growers in particular, but also the broader advisor, researcher, agronomist network, also hear from their views about what are the challenges, where should we be investing in blue sky research that is going to give us the next step change for the Australian grains industry and for growers.
And at the moment, there is a bit of a discussion around the levy that grain growers pay, some of which goes to the GRDC and the R&D program that you have. What will this discussion mean for the GRDC?
So any discussion and decisions around the levy are the responsibility for Grain Producers Australia, Grain Growers Limited, individual growers, and the government to actually determine that levy rate.
GRDC Chair Sharon Starick speaking to Cassie Huff, and you can find out more details about that online portal. Just go to the GRDC website and you can have your say there as well. Brooke Neindorf with you. It's almost coming up to news time, but it's 13 minutes to one.
80 years of the Country Hour, Australia's longest running radio show.
Hi, I'm Damien Somerville, a farmer from Burra. I'd like to congratulate the Country Hour on 80 years and I look forward to another fantastic 80 years.
Glenn Wilkinson from Snowtown, congratulations Country Hour on turning 80. You're a staple of Lunchtime Hour.
80 years of the Country Hour, Australia's longest running radio show. This is ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Now, Tunarama is back this weekend in Port Lincoln with the festival making its return after a couple of years off. The three-day festival is probably best known for its tuna toss competition, but another pretty special part of the event is the blessing of the fleet. Now, Port Lincoln's fishing fleet will be blessed before Tunarama officially opens on Friday night, along with a special ceremony at the Fisherman's Memorial to honour fishermen lost at sea. Mayor Diana Mislov will be opening Tunarama, but also has a connection to the blessing of the fleet and the Fisherman's Memorial, as she lost her fiancé at sea many years ago. I spoke with her about the importance of the blessing of the fleet.
The blessing of the fleet started way back in the early 60s, I think, or maybe even before. But it's really about honouring our seafood industry and our, particularly our tuna fishermen at that time, and seeing that fleet off to sea and in particular, just blessing and hoping and wishing and praying for safe return. It's just about safety. And, you know, to the credit of industry and facilities and organisations like the Australian Maritime Fisheries Academy, health and safety and work practices and standards have improved dramatically. But in those early days, you know, going to sea, and still today, going to sea is a high-risk, you know, venture. So, you know, we were also quite a religious community, and some of those things have changed over time, but in those times we were very religious and people prayed to God very religiously. So to have a blessing was a spiritual and a reverent occasion, and it was solemn to watch. You know, I was actually one of those women that would wave their husband off to sea, and or their fiance, or whoever, their partner off to sea, and you didn't know if they were going to come back. You know, and that is a real reality. So that blessing brought comfort and some kind of assurance and hope and faith that they'll come home.
And that tradition, or that, I guess, yeah, that blessing of those boats that are going out, that has continued, and it'll be happening next week in the to sort of start Chinarama. What will be happening on the night?
Okay, so we're actually bringing that event to the marina where the boats live, you know, in our commercial marina, the service wharf area. It starts at 4 p.m. We're encouraging the community to come along, bring a chair if they've got one. There'll be a formal proceeding where the Ministers Association will be actually offering a blessing to the fleet, and we'll hear from some speakers, and the Chinarama Festival itself will be officially opened at that event. There'll be seafood tastings. There'll be it's bringing it right home in the heart of the marina where our fishing industry is so important and prevalent. And it also honours the Fisherman's Memorial, which is right alongside the commercial wharf there. And this year we have some additional names that have been included on the memorial. So it will be wonderful to actually honour the history of not just Chinarama, but our fishing pioneers and the men mostly who have lost their lives at sea and have not returned home.
Tell us about the importance of that memorial and having it there, like you said, in the heart of the marina.
Oh, I think I just would really like to thank, I think it might have been the Tuna Boat Owners Association or, the fishing industry leaders at the time, particularly people like Mick Puglisi, who actually had the foresight to come and present to council in those days and get their backing to build a fisherman's memorial. Marijan Bekic was a local Croatian sculptor who came up with the vision for the sculpture. And on the one side you have, and let's face it, they are mostly women, the figures, looking out to sea, to Point Donington actually, and looking out to sea to, you know, farewell their fishing families. And on the other side, their faces are downcast because they are mourning the loss of the ones that did not return. And that memorial is significant for so many of us who have lost lives at sea and have nowhere to grieve. So it's an important memorial. The granite rocks around it that have the names of the vessels that were lost at sea and those individuals that were also lost is just so significant. You know, I personally have names on that memorial. My fiancé was lost at sea, and it gives us a place to go and reflect where there's no other place to go, you know, other than maybe to look out to the waters. But it's a wholesome connecting space where you feel like they're being honoured. It's so important.
And I was going to ask just about your fiancé as well, and he was lost at sea, but to be able to, you know, I guess this sort of full circle, you're mayor now and you'll be at this blessing of the fleet. What's an event like that like for you who has this real personal connection?
Oh, Brooke, I could cry about it. It is. Oh, it's so significant. I don't think we really know, you know, and I hate to say this, but, you know, until you've lost someone that hasn't come home, I don't think people understand that sense of grief that comes with that, that not knowing, and that hope and that prayer that maybe they're still out there, maybe they've found an island, maybe they're going to swim home, maybe something this, maybe this, maybe that.
And you just live in that constant hope that and faith that that they're still alive somewhere. So there's that whole horror of losing someone at sea. And I just hope, Brooke, that I can keep it together on the day. I'll have to practice what I'm going to say. And sorry to be emotional, but it is an emotional thing. And, you know, the whole blessing of the fleet for so many, that's what they feel. You know, that's what we feel every time we say goodbye. You just don't know. But in today's world, I mean, that can happen to any of us anytime. We should just love each other more, honestly. Every morning, when you get up in the morning, tell everyone that you love them, because you just don't know if they're coming home or not. So many things can happen. But back in those days, there was a real sad uncertainty of what the future out there was. There was less technology. There were no mobile phones, and, you know, there were, you know, UHFs and things like that. But it was just a different time. And you can see that from that fisherman's memorial, that the names have petered off, you know. So the industry standards have grown to such a degree, the technology is so much more improved that fortunately there have been less incidents of people losing their lives at sea. To be able to address the community about not just that fisherman's memorial, but the return of Tunarama will be exciting. So I'm really looking forward to Tunarama coming back. It's the heart and soul of who we are, the DNA of Port Lincoln. So that will be really exciting, and I look forward to that.
Port Lincoln Mayor Diana Mislov. Now, Ross Haldane is the president of the Tacoma Fishing Boat Preservation Society, and his family has long been involved in the fishing industry for a number of years, in particular with the tuna industry. And he says the blessing of the fleet has now got historical significance as part of Tunarama.
The blessing of the fleet really got a big kickoff during the first Tunarama, and there was about 12 boats all lined up down at the Brennan's Jetty, and more put their flags up, and everybody was there. It was quite a spectacular event. Port Lincoln, prior to that, I don't think had blessing of the fleets. Port Lincoln was never a strong sort of Catholic community, whereas Port Pirie and even Thevenard, I think they had that stronger tradition. In the early days, as Tunarama expanded and as the tuna fleet and the fishing fleet expanded, the blessing of the fleet and the sail pass was a really big thing. Unfortunately, a lot of things changed since then, a lot of legislation and how we're allowed to take people out on our boats. I mean, some of the boats just take 50 people out there. It was like sort of going down the Mekong River. And so that took sort of the wind out of the event where people couldn't participate. Hopefully this year's plan of having the blessing of the fleet as a stable structure in the marina with the boats surrounding all around, that gives everybody an opportunity to walk past the boats, to look at the boats, and this particularly, oh, this year they're going to have some seafood there. So it's turning it into an event, and that's good for the marina, because the marina does need more activities. It's there. It's like a beautiful town hall, but we don't use it enough.
And I guess also having that fisherman's memorial there as well adds to it too.
That does, because we can bless the boats when they go to sea, but sometimes those blessings apparently haven't worked too well. And we have lost men. We've lost about 50, since I came to Port Lincoln as a 4.5-year-old, we've lost over 50 men. And that's a big number in any industry. And so having a blessing of the fleet and having the fisherman's memorial there does sort of tie those two elements together. And having the fleet there and watching the fleet actually leave when they go on their fishing expeditions, they're actually leaving last couple of weeks. They've all gone tuna fishing. And it's like, there they go. And who knows, you know, what can happen out there. So I think having a symbolic sort of gathering of the fleet, probably if you're realistic, you would have the blessing of the fleet in October, prior to the fleet sort of going fishing. But anyway, it's at Tunarama, and hopefully down at the marina, it's going to be a very, very successful event.
Ross Haldane, who is the president of the Tacoma Fishing Boat Preservation Society, and his family has had many, many years of ties within the fishing industry, speaking there about the Blessing of the Fleet, which will be happening this Friday night. And you can find out all the details of that event, but also all the Chinarama events online if you're heading over to Port Lincoln, maybe to come over to Chinarama, which is back in all its glory after a couple of years in recess. So if you're coming over, maybe coming over to toss a tuna. That'll be good fun as well. That's all we've got time for on the Country Hour today. We have had a text come through. We were looking before about how the sales of vineyards have slowed right down. And Brian, thanks for texting in. He said vineyards, the government, buying water for environment, all very big hurdles when it comes to sales of vineyards, which is very true as well. That's all we've got time for. It's coming up to news time. We'll be back with you at the same time tomorrow. Enjoy the rest of your afternoon. It's 1 o'clock, news time.
How come chips are all the same shape? What's inside a football? I'm Dr. Carl. Let's go behind the scenes again and have a world of fun finding out.
Dr. Carl's How Things Work. Stream all the episodes now on ABC iView.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.